Welcome to Inside Ivy Hoops, the podcast about Ivy League basketball. We're back after a one-week hiatus, and it's good to be back. Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online, joined by the incomparable George Clark. George, how are you, sir?
Very fine, Mike. It's great to be with you the night before we head into the final weekend of the regular season.
Yeah, it's hard to believe we're at this point already. Wanted to start off the podcast with by far the most impressive team on either the men's or women's side this year across all of Ivy League basketball. The Princeton women, yet another Ivy League championship clinched. I don't know how many platitudes you can throw out there, but this defense, best in the nation, once again last weekend, getting it done with a impressive win against Yale on senior day at Jadwin, the Saturday game, followed by a 42-point win against Brown, holding the Bears somewhat predictably to 39. Although if you score 39 against Princeton, that's just under the average. So that's not even necessarily an embarrassing outing at this point. George, just broadly speaking, at this point, what are your thoughts on where the Tigers stand, what their ceiling is as the postseason approaches?
They stand atop both men and women in the Ivy League. I mean, what they've accomplished to this point is almost unprecedented. To have a new coach come in and instill a culture of defense to which the kids have freely bought in and have executed almost to perfection is really outstanding. It's a tribute to Carla Brube, but it's also, of course, a tribute to her players. And the roster is very, very deep. The player of the year is going to be Bella Allery again. I think this will be her third straight player of the year award, and she'll be first team All Ivy. I think this will be a clean sweep, I think, all 4 years. The spark plug is Carly Littlefield. And it just goes on and on. Abby Myers has come off the bench to spark a number of rallies that have been just incredible. Grace Stone has been a terrific performer. Taylor Bauer, a senior, we're going to miss because she's been very effective. Ellie Mitchell, who's a freshman, looks like she's going to step in to the scoring role next year. It's just a phenomenal team. Don't know what the ceiling is. They're playing well enough to get a pretty good seed. The year they won 30 games, they had to play at Maryland. It's just a very, very difficult thing to do. They might avoid that and perhaps get a chance to win two games.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And you make a good point about Ellie Mitchell. She's really coming on strong, had a double-double against Brown on Friday. And I don't know, just the overall takeaway for me from this season, and I think this is probably true of most Ivy folks looking on at this point, is just the coaching job that Carla Berube's been able to do. This is largely the same roster from last season. There's not a ton of turnover. That's why this team was expected to be great, frankly. But, we've seen just another level. The defense was not of this caliber last season.
They were expected to be great, and they have been great in a different way this year. Not that they don't score, because they do, but they've had more than half a dozen quarters this season where they've held opponents to single digits.
Yeah, you expect it at this
point. And that's often been in the third quarter of relatively close games.
Yeah, that's kind of been the signature this season, pulling away with a really decisive third quarter. Yeah, we were talking about Penn's defense last season and it being, among the best in the country. You know, the script has really been flipped, but the Tigers certainly have the scoring prowess to just push them way over the top.
And one of the interesting things about this season, and I'm not sure exactly why it is this, but it may be because the league is pretty good. In past years, you had to win a lot of games before the Ivy League season started in order to get any attention nationally. This year, Princeton has actually improved its ranking during the season. And I've been very surprised to see that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, they're proving themselves each weekend at this point to be, a team worthy of a higher seed than they got in 2015 when they had an undefeated regular season wound up playing in an 8-9 matchup and then falling in the second round to a one seed that they should not have had to have played.
On its home court. That's one thing about the way the women do it that maybe someday will change. But I understand that they can draw probably pretty well if you have a home team playing in the tournament. Up for teams coming in there, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's an advantage you get on the women's side that you do not get on the men's side as one of the top seeds in the tournament. And you know, I think that's probably something that the men's side does better. That's another conversation, I guess. The women's side also to be noted. You know, Princeton sits at the top of the league, but the team whose stock is rising the most at this point, I think, has to be Columbia, with former Princeton assistant and Columbia alumna Megan Griffith leading the way. Her program certainly on the rise. Columbia punching its ticket to its first ever Ivy League tournament. Really getting it done with big wins at Yale and at Harvard down the stretch of this season, and has another chance to impress further this weekend by getting Princeton and Penn. It's kind of a litmus test of sorts for the Lions, but Abby Hsu has been phenomenal in her rookie campaign. And what can you say? They're a fun team to watch too. You know, they're strong offensively, kind of the opposite of Cornell sneaking in last year as a team that is really defense oriented and tries to hurt you inside. Columbia is kind of a more wide open playmaking kind of feel when you watch their games. So congrats to them for Columbia to get to this milestone. I mean, when you look...
Absolutely, absolutely. Megan Griffith has just done a terrific job, and as a Princeton fan, I'm kind of proud of what she's done because she was a very, very key component in Courtney Banghart's program when she was here. and I guess I know her a little bit. She knows basketball. She's got a lot of passion for the game. Of course, was thrilled to be able to go back to Columbia. So I hope she's a year away. I'm glad to see that they've made the tournament. They could make some noise.
Yeah, they're two wins away from an all-time winning this season in program history, and you know their history isn't that long, which makes it even more impressive. They were slow to get to Division One. They didn't join until 1986. Yeah, there were some barriers to success, I suppose, when you look back, way back at the history. It would have been easy to use that as an excuse, I guess. But, congrats to the Lions. Flipping over to the men's side, you know, what can you say about that weekend? That was pretty wild. And really, my biggest takeaway from last weekend on the men's side was the fact that, you know, pre-Ivy tournament, the game of the weekend would most assuredly have been Princeton at Yale on Saturday. And to a degree, it still was a great game, a marquee matchup. But the game that seemed to get the most buzz and was in fact a very intense game that I think, you know, from some feedback on Twitter, kind of makes the argument for having an Ivy League tournament that teams are playing to get into at this point of the season, was the Penn at Brown game on Saturday instead. So instead of looking at the one seed situation, we're looking at the four. And, we're lowering our sights a little bit to think of it that way, which is one of the reasons why I was against the tournament to begin with, and frankly still am. But, you know, I won't deny that, for Ivy League basketball fans, watching that back and forth game at Pizzitola Sports Center wasn't that was a good game. I can see the value in that. Of course, Penn coming out on top, 73-68, with a 45-point second half, getting it done offensively when they needed to, just to stay in Ivy League tournament contention. Penn would have been out of the tournament for the first time with a loss, but as it is, they have the inside track with Cornell and Columbia at home. George, what were your thoughts on the narrow Princeton loss, 66-63, in New Haven?
I had a chance. I wasn't in New Haven, but I did watch the game. And I had the feeling throughout the game that it was not going to be a Princeton win. I know they made it very close, but I never had the feeling that they were going to be able to come back all the way. So I wasn't really surprised. It was surprising to me that it got to be as close as it did in the last minute, a one position game. And but to me, the big news of the weekend was the fact that Brown did so poorly at home, with a chance at home to punch its ticket to the tournament. I was really surprised that we held them to 49 points and beat them by 22. That was shocking to me. And then to have still have a chance at home against Penn, a team they had beaten on the road, and then to come up as short as they did, I was just surprised that Brown did kind of collapse here.
Yeah, Brown has not matched up well at all against Princeton this season. You know, that on paper, you that would seem to be a more even matchup, but it just, you know, it just hasn't played out that way. Princeton really.
No, it was really surprising. They came up to New Jersey after beating Penn in the Palestra, and it wasn't much of a game at all. It was shocking to me at that point. And then to collapse at home with a chance to go to the tournament, it just was really surprising. And Brandon Anderson, who was, as far as I'm concerned, a first-teamer, really did not come up well on senior night Saturday.
No, not after scoring 31 against Penn at the Palestra. All eyes were on him. And, yeah, Penn did a great job of limiting him. You know, I think he only had one trip to the free throw line, which for him is, you know, that's extremely low.
Not to take anything away from Penn, because they went in there and did what they had to do with everything on the line. So hats off to Steve Donohue, who seems to come from off the canvas every year.
Well, yeah, I mean, Penn's defense, you know, I credit them more for what they were able to do rather than, you know, pointing the finger at certainly any individual one of Mike Martin's players. That game, I feel like that the second half, I thought Penn, you know, doing so well offensively against a team that shut them down in the second half at the Palestra, that was really the difference. The first half kind of played out almost exactly how you'd think it would, with two pretty strong defensive teams and frankly teams that have not shot the ball well at all throughout much of Ivy League play. Brown's offense has struggled, so you know that kind of intense defensive battle in the first half is what you expected, or at least what I did. But the second half, you know, Penn was able to find another gear, some big shots from Max Martz and AJ Broder doing what he does. And now all Penn has to do to get in the tournament is beat two teams at the Palestra who have not won any road games this season combined. So now the jinx is in.
Well, that's really why Brown's performance last week at home is mystifying to me, because Mike Martin knows the schedule and he knows what it's like to go down to the Palestra. He's won there, but that's a very difficult place to play. And Brian Earle, Jim Ingles are going in there and they have nothing to lose and everything to gain in terms of respect. So I don't think it's going to be a cakewalk for the Quakers, but I'd certainly give them the edge in both games.
No, it's never a cakewalk, not with Penn. You know, Penn has done a great job of, you know, playing up to its level of competition, but also going the other way as well. And frankly, that, you know, Cornell and Columbia have both, just because they haven't been able to pull out wins in some cases on the road this season, does not mean that they haven't been extremely competitive and worthy of wins multiple times each. And I should clarify, I didn't get that quite right earlier. I'm sure Brown fans are not happy with my characterization of Penn's chances of getting into the tournament. Penn actually technically does not control its own destiny. Neither team really does, because of the tiebreakers. If Brown sweeps the weekend and they have you know, the at Harvard, at Dartmouth trip, and Yale wins at Dartmouth, and Harvard also would then beat Yale, then Brown would get in. So basically, you know, Harvard being the top seed, despite getting swept by Brown, is what has to happen for Brown to get in, to get that tiebreaker, that second tiebreaker since Penn and Brown split the season series.
If Harvard sweeps this weekend, I believe Harvard would then get the number one seed, having beaten Yale twice.
Right, but then that would mean that Brown would lose one game and then Penn would control its own destiny at that point.
Well, Harvard has a lot to play for.
You're right. You're right. As far see, that's the thing. I'm talking about the number four seed. You know, when we would have always started with the number one seed prior to the tournament. But we already know that Yale will be there, as they seemingly always will under James Jones, get in the top four. But
I got an invitation from the Friends of Princeton Basketball to a reception on Saturday afternoon before the tournament. And it was, the highlight was, come and see Princeton play in the 2-3 game. And that's exactly what will happen. Princeton will either be second or third.
Right. Yeah. And look, it's yes, that is, they're locked into either the two or the three. They don't know at this point who the opponent will be, of course.
The way it shapes up, Princeton's going to have to beat Harvard on its home court and then beat Yale, or vice versa. But they're going to have to beat Harvard and Yale in order to win the tournament. That's tough.
It is. It's a tall order. But why don't we look ahead at the weekend to come and try to game out what could happen, what might happen, what we think may not happen. Friday's got a lot of intriguing matchups with the stakes high. Yale goes to Dartmouth. That's an interesting game when you look at Dartmouth had started out 0-6 in league play and is now at 5-7. And if it wasn't for that Chris Knight shot against Princeton in the final second, rolling off the rim in that matchup with the Tigers, that would have won the game. They could be tied with Penn and Brown right now, just that easily.
That was really one of the strangest finishes of the season. I really. I was so pleased and relieved that we got out of there with a win. And Henderson has talked frequently about the job that David McLaughlin's doing up there. At one point, early in the season, I think Dartmouth was 0-4, and Mitch said, that's the best 0-4 team I've ever seen. They've given Princeton a lot of problems, and they can give anybody a lot of problems, especially in Hanover. So, boy, it's not going to be an easy weekend for Yale and Brown going up there.
No, not at all. And they're certainly well positioned to spoil Yale's Ivy League title hopes on Friday, and Brown's hopes to get in on Saturday, and also Penn's hopes too if tiebreakers. Make that Yale Dartmouth Friday matchup matter. So we'll see how things play out here.
Well, it's interesting that the tournament format really makes for meaningful games in the last weekend of the season. There's only one spot open this year, but we've gotten to the last couple games with multiple spots open in previous years, and I think it really adds something. I was, as an old fogey, I was never in favor of the tournament, but I certainly enjoyed it.
Yeah, it gives meaning to places where it wasn't before, and it still does matter. I think it's definitely a point of pride to get the Ivy League regular season championship, also known as simply the Ivy League championship, as the league recognizes it. But yeah, what can you say? Yale at Harvard. In a regular season finale, quite possibly with championship on the line.
With the championship on the line and number one seed in the tournament on the line. And I won't say it's funny, but it's kind of ironic that Yale would find itself going into the last weekend in that situation, because they've really been dominant this year. Let's face it. Terrific starters and good kids off the bench too. I'm not knocking the fifth guy, but Bruner, Atkinson, Monroe, and Azar Swain have just been really, really big time players. Their margin this year is 10 points, which dwarfs anybody else. And their scoring defense isn't bad. But for the referees, with a five-minute video review at the end of the game in New Haven, after Azar. So, of course, Harvard committed one of the worst fouls I've ever seen this year or any year with a four-point lead, gave Swain a chance to tie the game. Video review, 5 minutes, and he bricked the shot. Harvard escaped. But for that, they could very well be have one loss.
Yeah, well, and they could push that the other way too. They were very close many times to they were just an inbound pass away, and then another inbound pass away, and then another inbound pass away from possibly losing to Penn, which
twice they would have lost twice.
It would have got. Penn was very, very close to a sweep. What can you say? This is just a truly surreal final 98 seconds. You know, I give full credit to Yale and particularly Dalen Gabadon for coming up with steal after steal. Down the stretch there, a very legitimate candidate for Ivy Defensive Player of the Year for sure, stepping into Trey Fields' shoes well on James Jones' roster. But if you're one of Penn's guards in that situation, you cannot dribble into traps. You cannot let players simply take the ball from you. Just tear it out of your hand. That's just a surreal collapse. We've seen those games before, where a team just seems to run out of gas out of nowhere. It happened to Yale at Penn State back in November. Had a 8-point lead with under 3 minutes left and did not score again. And a very good Penn State team was able to eke that win out in State College. And
that's a good win. If you can beat Yale, and I don't care where it is, you've earned it. Really, that was a good win for Penn State, even though they were at home.
It was a good win for Penn State. It would have been a great win for Yale. But the fact that it could have went either way should tell you that Yale is in fact an NCAA tournament caliber team, whether they ultimately get there or not. They are that caliber, and this is, one of these years there's going to be an upset. We haven't seen in the Ivy League tournament, we haven't seen, other than the two seeds on their home floor winning, You know,
the closest thing to an upset was in the very first tournament.
The first game.
When Penn led the entire into the last 5 seconds, and Miles Stevens, who is now one of the beneficiaries in my will, had that putback to tie it. That play happened 10 feet from where I was sitting, and I almost fainted.
Yeah, it looked like Penn had it. And that would have been such a wild, turning the tournament on its head.
There's a game they talk about in 1989. They characterize it as the game that saved March Madness when Georgetown beat Princeton in the last seconds. That Penn Princeton game might have saved the Ivy League tournament because of Penn. Had won that game, everybody would have looked silly.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The very first game, an undefeated team clearly poised to go to the NCAA tournament, getting a bid robbed by a team that started the conference play 0-6, on Penn's home floor, would have been just. That would have been a bitter pill for the league to have had to swallow. So I'm sure everyone in the league was probably should have been grateful that Miles Stevens came up with that play. So one of these days, though, there is going to be an upset, and you know, it would be a real shame to see this Yale team that is still a top 60 team in KenPom, even though they don't necessarily have any huge eye-popping wins. Now, they did beat Clemson on the road. They did beat Vermont.
And they will be, even if they get upset in the Ivy League tournament. But of course, that's far out of our hands.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously will not make it if they don't. They have to win the tournament to get in. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. Anything else you're looking for on the men's weekend? Princeton wrapping up with Columbia, and then Cornell at home get to finish their regular season with another Brian Earle versus Mitch Henderson coaching matchup at Jadwin.
It'll be great to see Brian again. It's always nice to see him, and he's done a good job at Cornell under very, very trying circumstances. Those kids play for him. A lot of times they're outmatched, but they're never outfought.
No.
And it's senior night on Saturday at Princeton. Last year it was senior night at home against Yale, and just got murdered after having been beaten the night before by Brown. Then went to New Haven and played Yale, and we should have won that game. If you recall, we came from 14 down at halftime, took a 7-point lead, Miles Stevens fouls out, and the rest is history. But it's just ironic how things can turn around here. Nobody expected Princeton to do so well against Yale in the tournament. So that upset that you've been somewhat whimsical about could very well happen. It will happen. It's a question of when. And Penn is playing pretty well right now. So, boy, I would not suggest to you that Penn can't have that upset in the first round against Yale because they've already beaten them.
Well, yeah, I mean, that seems to have been a matchup that has actually worked to Penn's favor. You know, if you take away those last 98 seconds, you know, it was Penn wasn't a better team in both games. You know, I think there's definitely a bit of luck there, though, with Swain just not having good shooting nights. Now, Penn gets some credit for that, you know, harassing him, you know, trying to make his life difficult during games, and they succeeded with that. But, you know, if a shooter is very hot, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, there's not a lot of analysis to be done sometimes. Yeah, it's interesting that Princeton, the last couple of years, has done much better against Yale, not at Jadwin. Basically, yeah, not. They've done better in New Haven against Yale than at Jadwin. Not a lot of teams can say that when you're talking about Jadwin performances. So flipping over to the women's side, it's pretty stunning to see Harvard have fallen to this point. You know, we knew that things would be tough with Katie Benson out of the picture. But, you know, Harvard started out strong, win over Penn. They really improved defensively, I would say significantly from last season. You know, lower scoring team, but they're doing a better job defensively. Lola Mullaney has been a terrific first year for them. But, I just haven't been able to put it together down the stretch. And, you know, now they travel to Brown and Yale. And at this point, you know, having the Ivy League tournament on your home floor and not being in it, something that Yale had to go through last season, you know, that's you know, it's tough. Also interesting, you know, with Columbia getting in, you know, Dartmouth now the only program not to have either the men's or the women teams get in to the Ivy League tournament. So, like to see parity in the league. So hopefully Dartmouth gets in on one or both sides next season.
Especially when they're hosting it. That's not too far off. That is going to be a very interesting situation because I can't imagine that Hanover is going to draw crowds for the Ivy League tournament. I hope I'm wrong. And I hope Dartmouth is represented on either side at that point. But that's really quite a mystifying situation. But the league is just brilliant in all its decisions.
Yeah, and all its infinite wisdom. I mean, I get the it's a TV decision. It's a branding decision. It's a competitive advantage decision, I suppose, not wanting it to be certainly at the Palestra every year. That I don't think was ever going to fly, you know, it, especially not after the Penn men won there as the 2 seed and on nearly won as the 4, as we already mentioned. But, you know, Yeah, when we get to that point, and we know it's not next season.
I'll be hosting all my Ivy Hoops Online friends at Old Nassau.
It's at your place.
It's at George's my place.
Yeah. We know folks will be traveling there. There's plenty of room. You know, but yeah, we'll see. But, you know, and it's not like the programs for Dave McLaughlin and Bell Kaklanis have been, you know, they've been pretty close. You know, they've both teams have just needed a little bit more offensive firepower this season. That's been what's missing that could have put either one easily, I think, over the top, given the fundamentals and the defensive intensity already being there. But I did want to note a few extracurriculars. The NCAA, and this is old news at this point, but worth noting in this space, since there was no podcast last week. The NCAA, of course, issued penalties against Jerome Allen, against Penn Athletics, against the Penn Men's Basketball Program. Released on the 26th, statement and report detailing its investigation into Allen, who received bribes from a Florida businessman, Philip Esformus, to place his son Morris on the recruited athletes list for the class of 2015. Penn Athletics coming out and saying that they weren't really necessarily on board with the punishment, which was not nearly as bad as severe as the punishment that Allen got, which was a 15-year show cause order. And that's the longest in NCAA history. On probation, there's a $5,000 financial penalty, 3-week ban on recruiting communications for men's basketball, for a 2 10-day periods in May and June. And also a reduction in recruiting person days for the 19-20 academic year, among other guidelines that were set forth. But the Penn saying it was unfortunate that the process didn't differentiate wrongdoing for personal gain versus wrongdoing for competitive gain. And that it is true, no doubt, that Penn did not gain competitively from Jerome Allen putting a player on the team that he didn't think was Division I caliber. That only hurt the program competitively. Didn't help it. But interesting that I saw on Twitter reactions varied pretty wildly to this. Some saying that Penn got away pretty much scot free, were let off the hook. And the opposite, that Penn shouldn't have been put on probation for something that that Allen did that really didn't benefit the program, didn't give them any competitive advantage. But I don't know. I don't really feel strongly one way or the other about it. When you break the rules, there's repercussions, and he was a steward of the program, and the program stands to lose in that situation. Although it's true there was only disadvantage rendered from it for Penn, and now that disadvantage continues.
Well, my quick take on it, Mike, is first of all, it's a tragedy for Penn in general, and for Jerome Allen, who was just a tremendous player and a big asset to the league in his playing days, but I think it was his fault. There's no question about it, and I don't know that Penn as an institution deserved to be punished. But I think the accountability of the institution is a message to other institutions to monitor situations a little more closely. How Jerome was able to do what he did without the administration at some level being aware of it is mystifying to me. We'll never know that. But Penn fortunately isn't going to be punished severely, but I think it is a message to programs in general that you've got to monitor these things closely, and it applies to all sports, not just basketball. But we'll move on.
Yeah, I mean, it Rob Brown made a good point on the website that the report noted that all former men's basketball staff members and athletics administrators indicated the head coach, Allen, never discussed any of his trips to Miami or the prospect, other than to remind them he was in the incoming class of recruits. But a Sports Illustrated article, a deep dive into the situation, published in July, suggested that, Allen, this was known. Allen.
Well, it's hard to believe that it wasn't known, but we'll never know. I guess the point is that, as I suggested earlier, that institutions, basketball, athletic departments around the nation will certainly take notice of how the institution has been sanctioned here, and it might be a deterrent to misconduct in the future, as personal as this particular episode was to Jerome Allen.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is what it is at this point, and now it's over. Finally over. But the other nugget I wanted to throw out there is the fact that was reported yesterday by the Harvard Crimson Online that schools, each qualifying school to the Ivy League tournament this year, will be allocated just 40 student tickets a game. Distribution coming next week. We talked about, Hanover, people not going to Hanover in the future. But the other aspect of concerns over the rotational system of the tournament now is the fact that these arenas are going to be getting smaller and smaller. We're now at one of the smallest already, the Leviades, with lead still to come. JLA was pretty small last year, but of course, you talk about lead and Pizzatola Sports Center and we're talking about small gyms here. 40 student tickets. That's not a lot. If what you want to do is try to raise interest, it's tough because if you don't have them on the schools on the campuses, then that's a hardship for the students to get to a neutral site in, say, Connecticut or somewhere like that. But I don't know. I mean, if there was a slam dunk solution, pardon the pun, I think we would have come to it by now. But that strikes me as a low number.
Well, I agree. It is a low number. But I also believe that the whole idea of the Ivy League tournament as a television-driven situation, all the games will be available on the ESPN platform, some of them nationally broadcast, and I think that's really what's driving things now. And the Ivy League will say, well, sure, we want to drive interest up, and the way we do it is by exposing this tournament on a nationwide available platform. They may be right, they may be wrong, but there's only a limited number of seats available for students.
It is, but that's a good point, though, George. That is the strategy. You have to build the brand, and they will come. You can reach a lot more people on TV. Let's hope that, you know, there are people at the game. you know,
well, there will be. Levitis is small enough that it's going to sell out, especially if it'd be great if both teams, both Harvard teams, could be there. But certainly the men are going to be there. And I think you're going to see a lot of interest in the tournament in Boston. Let's just hope that there isn't a pandemic issue next week.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to. As you and I were talking about before we started to record, George, the fact that they're, you know, the ever looming threat of the coronavirus at this point. You know, there's a presence in Boston now, and you know, there has been buzz that, you know, we may see some tournaments, conference tournaments, get played before a crowd of no one as a precaution. But, we'll see. Hopefully it's status quo and it doesn't come
back. I'm hoping to attend, and I'm 70 plus in terms of my age, and I'm the target of in terms of the demographic groups of that particular virus. So I'll have to think about it. A lot can happen in the next 6-7 days, and it wouldn't shock me if they said the Ivy League said, "Well, we're going to play this tournament on TV, and we're not going to let anybody in."
Yeah, well, hey, people shouldn't live in their fears. I mean, follow what the scientists say is all I can say. You know, whatever the science is suggesting is in these snapshots of time as we get closer. You know, that's all.
I expect to be at the tournament and filing report after report to IHO.
Well, that's what we want. That's what we want. The only the only sickness we want is a fever for more Ivy League basketball. We got plenty to come. George Clark, thank you so very much for coming on Inside Ivy Hoops, as always, to impart your round ball wisdom as we get set for one final regular season weekend to go.
Well, it's been a treat for me over the years, perhaps this year as much as any, to contribute to IHO. I know you're doing a fabulous job, Mike, and I know a lot of people out there look forward to what's online, what's available. A lot of people follow it, and that's great.